As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today.
Welcome to the Rocket Ship Podcast. I'm Matt Goldman.
I'm Michael Sacca.
And I'm Joelle Steiniger. Today we talked with Greg Beaufait of Dundee Capital. What did you guys think?
So this was really interesting. He had written a post, Will the Real Seed Funds Please Stand Up? And it was all about the kind of shifting in capital that's happening at the smaller stages. And so it was really interesting to get to hear his view as a VC out of the Midwest as to what is happening kind of nationwide. What'd you guys think?
Yeah, there was a lot of good advice in here for companies at any stage, really. He talked about how the different stages and markets can affect you no matter where you are and what that means for how you do fundraising in your company and maybe how you should be a bit more opportunistic when you can. So let's get into it. Wistia is a video hosting platform built specifically for business. If you're using video as a part of your marketing strategy, you need to be able to measure its impact. Wistia is helping over 175,000 businesses do just that with premium video hosting, lead generation tools, and in-depth video analytics. For more about Wistia, visit wistia.com/rocketship.
All right. So tell us a bit about Dundee VC.
So we're based at Omaha, Nebraska, in an early stage fund. We say seed. Some people call it pre-seed. So we're operating off an $18 million fund right now, which is our second fund. We raised it in 2012. So our thesis is there's a lot of early stage companies in the Midwest that need capital, especially as kind of the cost to create companies has decreased over the last decade or so. And there's not a lot of knowledgeable early stage capital for those companies. So that's where we invest in, and sometimes the back of my napkin ideas, and usually companies that are first starting to get those first few customers is where we come in and provide kind of that institutional knowledge and help you figure out your funding path to A, B, C, D, and beyond.
So you recently wrote an article, Will the Real Seed Funds Please Stand Up? And it was kind of talked a lot about the ecosystem today, the emergence of these micro VCs. Why do you see the micro VC as an emerging trend kind of popping up nationwide?
Yeah, so it's compelling. I mean, the cost to start a startup have been getting cheaper. The cost to maybe scale startups, not so much, but you can create a startup really, really cheaply these days. You can hack together an MVP, kind of that initial prototype, and sell it to consumers, to customers, whether you're B2B or B2C, you can get people to start using for really, really cheaply. So that means there's a lot of kind of early stage investors that are like, okay, I'm seeing a lot of deals that can get off the ground really quickly and really cheaply. And there's been just a flurry of capital at our stage. So when we went and raised the fund in 2012, there was only, I think, about 70 or 80 micro VCs, which is kind of under 50 million is the generally accepted term for that. Now there's hundreds, I think 300 or 400 is the latest count. So just a ton of capital at the early stage and a ton of companies getting off the ground there as well.
So when you say micro VC, so it's the amount raised at the LP level, do you see trends in how much they invest and the equity that they tend to take?
Yeah, so it varies across the funds that we invest with and the deals we're seeing. Some are really kind of not ownership based, but they just want to be in the hottest deals. So they want to build a brand for themselves with so many micro VCs out there. Mm. So some are ownership based and some are just, you know, trying to hack their shingle out there and say, hey, we're here, we're open for business. We're trying to chase deals and be in the best deals. So I don't know if there's a trend necessarily or a common theme across ownership, but I think there's certainly a lot of capital driving valuations up, making it harder to be ownership driven at this stage.
So what about on the side of the startups? Are you seeing trends in the size of deals and the valuations that are going on?
Yeah, I think the valuations are getting higher and the round sizes are getting larger as well. I think it's really kind of, you know, the power law that people always talk about, the top, you know, 1% or even top 0.1% of venture deals drive the vast majority of returns. I think we're kind of seeing that as well. In the deals that the funds are chasing, they all want to be in kind of the hottest deal. They all want to be in the biggest round at the highest valuation, which doesn't really make sense from an economic return perspective, but it makes sense because it's kind of sexy. And the deals you want to be in, and it's a really entrepreneurial friendly, founder friendly time to be raising capital, especially at our stage, given just the influx of money. So that's driving round sizes up. And valuations up. I mean, why wouldn't you take the extra capital for the same amount of dilution if you had the choice? It seems like a no-brainer. Sometimes it can kind of flood the company, which is what we caution our companies against and kind of what I wrote about in the article. But as an entrepreneur, it's hard to sit in their seat and tell them, don't take that extra dollar.
So it seems like there's kind of a misunderstanding of the implication of taking more money. And that, you know, a lot of companies actually can put themselves out of business by taking too much. Is that because they're getting convinced from external forces and even those in the venture capital world that the most money you can get, you know, take it? Or is it kind of like the notch in your belt of how much you can raise? Like, why do you think that there's such a misunderstanding about the negative implications of taking a larger first round?
Well, I think entrepreneurs in general and investors as well are very ego-driven. I mean, you have to be to start a company and think you're going to be the top dog in the industry and build something that no one else has thought of or been able to execute on before. So I think that plays a part in it and certainly press, you know, covering not necessarily revenue metrics or any kind of actual business-related metrics. And more covering more funding events and what sexy plays a part in it as well. I think it's really ego driven at the end of the day. Like, I want to be in the hottest deal. I want to raise the most money, and it's not a competition to see who can raise the most money, right? It's a competition to see who can still be in business 5, 7, 10 years down the road. But I think sometimes that gets lost in the day to day and especially in fundraising. I think if you raise too much money for kind of this stage of your company, it can really be dangerous and you just end up burning too much money.
So in your article, kind of along those same lines, you mentioned Jet.com. And I'm wondering if you can walk us through that deal so we can understand kind of how much they raised and what are the metrics that they actually need to hit to stay alive, essentially.
Yeah, so Jet's a crazy idea. I mean, they're betting on the founder, right? I think his name is Mark. I'm not sure on his last name, but he sold Quidsy.com, diapers.com to Amazon for I think around $600 million, and he comes back and he says, "All right, now I'm gonna take down Amazon. We need to flip this e-commerce model on its head." And it's a massive, massive undertaking, right? Like, you see how big of a company Amazon is, how well they're doing, and how much of a stranglehold they have on e-commerce. Like, taking that down, you need a lot of capital. And so even before launch, like, to just build the massive undertaking that is, all the warehouses they need across the country for two-day shipping, you know, all the inventory they need to have on hand to offer the prices, the bulk discounts with retailers. They just needed to raise a ton of money to make it happen and to be able to attract the talent and employees to take on Amazon. So they raised $225 million before launch. I think, you know, since launching a few months ago, they've raised even more capital. I think the latest thing I saw was $3 billion was their valuation. And they're losing money hand over fist, but on purpose, because they need to get to, I think, $20 billion in volume to make the model work long term. So it's a big, big bet. And $20 billion sounds like a lot, but if you look at Amazon's market cap, it's only a fraction of that. So if they can get to that scale, the $3 billion valuation makes a ton of sense, and the bets on the founding team and the employees that they've been able to attract so far.
And then let's kind of counter that with, you mentioned Slack and Mattermark. What was your take on kind of how they built out or built up to their Series A rounds?
Yeah, so those two are an example of companies that raised a little bit of money, I think maybe a couple $1 million apiece, on the backs of a different idea. So Danielle at Mattermark had a startup, I think it was called Recurly, that went through Y Combinator. And then after Y Combinator hit a little bit of a slump, they had some money in the bank and they just realized, hey, this isn't working. We've got money in the bank. Our investors don't necessarily want, you know, pennies on the dollar back. What are we seeing out there? What have we learned? What can we build with this capital that can be a high growth company? And the nice thing there was they'd only raised a couple $1 million. They'd raised the right amount of capital for their stage. They had the option to kind of buckle down, go to two or three employees, you know, eat the old ramen for lunch, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and find an idea that worked and started to take hold. And Slack was actually the same way. I think it was the first investment was in a gaming company.
Yep.
But they'd use this internal communication tool for their workforce, and then just word of mouth in Silicon Valley, everyone else started saying, wow, this is really cool. This is really cool. Let's use it for our team. And all of a sudden they've got one of the fastest growing companies ever. And the reason they were able to kind of buckle down and even switch that model was they'd raised the right amount of money for their company. They hadn't kind of gotten too big for their britches, because if you look at a jet.com, there's no chance they're ever going to go to a different business model. Like, they've raised hundreds of millions of dollars. They've got hundreds of millions of dollars of liquidation preferences outstanding based on that one business model, and they have to hit billions of dollars in volume to make it work. Whereas something like Slack and Mattermark, they'd raise the right amount of money. They didn't have too many investors saying, hey, we need our liquidation back. Just shut our things down and let's take our pennies on the dollar. They were able to kind of pivot and say, let's figure out an idea that actually works with the capital we have left. They had optionality, and sometimes skipping, you know, that seed round or that early A rounds and raising the big bucks doesn't give you that optionality. You've only got one avenue you can go down with your company.
So, and then we've also seen kind of the news about Zirtual. What happened there, and why couldn't they make it work?
So I think there are a few things at play based on what I've read up on it. I think one was just general financial, I don't want to say incompetence, because I don't know them, but we see this with a lot of our founders. They don't really understand their finances down to the dollar. And when you outsource accounting and finance, which happens a lot, I mean, a lot of our companies at the early stage do it, but when you outsource that as kind of a 400 employee company and you switch your workers from 1099s to actual employees, there's a lot of complexity going on. And they were burning a lot of cash too. They didn't have many options besides kind of raising that note they thought was going to come in the door, and ended up not coming in the door. And I think there it's mostly a case of just burning too much money. Like, you've got to have a handle on your burn rate. And they had a really good volume and a really good revenue run rate. I think they're on pace to do $11 million a year in revenue, but they were just burning too much cash. So I mentioned in the article, when you're thinking through fundraising, one, you've got to leave yourself optionality. So if things don't go well, you can flip the switch to profitability. And that's not easy. But you've always got to have that in the back of your mind, and they didn't.
So you mentioned that Mattermark had optionality and that they were able to hunker down and really change what they were doing in order to have a better shot at success. Danielle from Mattermark tweets a lot about, what if the market adjusts or anything changes? What's your plan for what to do? Do you have any advice for companies that are you know, maybe have high burn now, what's a good hunker down plan for them if some external factor changes?
Yeah, so I think generally just know where you're going to cut costs, and where you're going to cut costs is probably the things that, that don't directly correlate with revenue. So you might be building product ahead of yourselves. You might have, you know, a heavy spend on engineering thinking long term. If it doesn't directly correlate with revenue, that might be something I'd have top of mind for what we'd have to cut. And the other piece is that's really hard on a company's morale, even if you do cut development or wherever it is, and it does make sense at the time. That's really hard to go from, say, a company with 60 employees to 30 employees just because, you know, the markets have shifted and we weren't able to fundraise. So I think hiring, I don't really want to say, you know, slow down necessarily, because we're VCs, we're investing for growth and fast growth, but just be very careful that you're not hiring ahead of yourself.
So in the article, you mention optimizing for partnership, not evaluation. Can you kind of take us through what that means?
Sure. So there's a lot of money at this early stage. There's a lot of money at almost every stage in venture capital right now. And I think what that means is it's become sexy. There's a lot of people wandering in. There's a lot of new avenues for funding on AngelList. There's crowdfunding. Not all capital is created equal. There's certain types of capital. There's certain investors within a broad group. So within VCs as compared to something like AngelList as compared to crowdfunding. There's differences between those. There's also differences between VCs, right? Make sure you're choosing a partner who can add value to your company, who's aligned with kind of your long-term vision. If you're taking angel money and that angel's expecting a 2x return, or that angel's investing purely out of the goodness of his heart, that's a lot different than taking VC money where they might be expecting, you know, a 20x or 30x return. So just knowing what you're getting into and optimizing for an investor that's aligned with your vision long-term and also short-term, the steps it takes to get there is critical. It comes down to communication, but I think it's important to know not all capital is created equal.
So before we kind of hit record, we were talking about the public market's effect on the private market. Can you walk us through kind of what some of the recent developments have been in the public market that may affect evaluations on the private market?
Yeah, sure. So I do want to mention this as well. Just what kind of I mentioned in the article, there's this huge influx of money at the seed stage, at the early stage, and also at later stages. And it seems like everyone's paying higher valuations. That might be warranted, but it's going to take a long, long time to actually flesh that out. I mean, it takes 5, 7, 10 years for these companies to get that initial investment, scale, and then return capital. So it kind of remains to be seen if those higher valuations are actually warranted. And a lot of kind of what that follows in the near term is the public market comps. So the public market on the tech side, as Bill Gurley had a tweet storm about this yesterday, has really gotten crushed in the last 6 to 8 weeks. So the big names, you're looking at Twitter, Salesforce, Google, as a whole, most of those are down, you know, anywhere from 25% to 50% over the last 6 to 8 weeks, which really just crushes what they're trading at in terms of multiples. And a lot of those late stage private market valuations are based on public multiples, because you think these companies are going to go public in the next year to two. So if a public company as an indexer is trading at something like 8 to 10x sales, I think Google's at 6x right now, Twitter's at 9 or 10x trailing 12-month sales, and Salesforce is in that range too, 7 to 8x. If those come down significantly, which they have, that'll also affect the late stage private markets, and the premiums that investors have been paying are no longer going to hold water. So that next round of capital, when they do need to raise it, may come at a down round, or when they IPO, it may not be an uptick in valuation, which has a lot of just downstream impacts in terms of anti-dilution provisions and a lot of other things that are just not good for the company. So there could be a real tightening of the belt, of the purse strings here in the late stage. And I think what it means is kind of what I mentioned in the article. You've got to have a vision to profitability. You've got to have an option other than just raising more money at a higher valuation, because it's not necessarily always going to be there.
So are you saying that the smaller exits of a company like Uber into the public market, will that affect the capital that's going into the seed stage?
It will long term.
Long term.
I think.
Okay.
I think it'll take a long time to trickle down. I mean, I think the public markets most immediately affect those companies like Uber that are going to go public in the next, you know, 12, 15 months. And then they affect the series C and D, and then they affect B and then A and then C. And by that time, the public markets might be thinking something completely different. So I think it takes a while to affect the seed stage, which is why, you know, for us, we really kind of want to stay rooted in our philosophy, and, you know, not necessarily value investors, but being cognizant of valuation and not overpaying for deals where there's a lot of heat around them.
So what does all this mean for seed stage founders that are listening? What can they do differently to prepare themselves for all these changes that are happening?
Yeah, so I think it's a good question. I think never be reliant, like don't wait until it's too late to raise money. So what that means is a lot of founders at the seed and A stages, and our founders too sometimes, they think of the runway as kind of a timeline for raising money. So if I'm 6 months from out of cash, you know, I'm going to start thinking about raising money. You should be thinking about raising money always, and also thinking about raising money opportunistically. So it's not necessarily when I'm 6 months out of cash or 3 months from out of cash. It's when I have the metrics that can really get me that next round of capital. I mean, capital is pretty cheap right now. So I'd encourage you to raise money opportunistically, but don't raise too much money that you don't have optionality with the business.
That's great advice. Well, thanks so much for coming on. Can you let everybody know where they can keep up with you online?
Yep, sure. My Twitter handle is @GBoffet. So happy to kind of engage in the discussions there. And then my email, if anyone has any questions or wants to get a hold of me, is greg@dundeevc.com. Feel free to reach out.
Perfect. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Rocket Ship Podcast. If you enjoyed it, we have tons of other awesome episodes on our website. Check them out, rocketship.fm.
And be sure to check out our app discount section, where we have discounts on products that we use every day, like Woo Themes, Wistia, Treehouse. Go to rocketship.fm/essentials and get your discounts today. See me by myself, you keep me clambering, just trying to hold my breath. I know that you're done, 'cause you're gone, my friend. And I know that you're gone. Love.